local journalist put to me two direct and pointed questions. Why is it important to celebrate this anniversary, he asked, and what has the NAACP achieved during the last 100 years? He didn't ask the question derisively. He was, you know, journalists want takeaways, as they say. I first quipped to the latter question, that is, what has the NAACP achieved during the last 100 years? I quipped, how much time do we have? On the chance that there are those among you who would also like some answers to these questions, I would like to take a few minutes to do so here. Late in 1956, W.E.B. Du Bois addressed the letter to the board of directors of the NAACP. Gentlemen, he began, I am venturing to write to remind you that the year 1957 will usher in a series of centenaries which deeply affect the history of the Negroes and the history of this country. May I point out a few, he said. 1957, 100th anniversary of the Dred Scott decision. 1959, 100th anniversary of the death of John Brown. 1961 to 1965, 100th anniversary of the participation of American Negroes in the Civil War. 1968, 100th anniversary of the death of Thaddeus Stevens, of the enfranchisement of the freedmen, and of the Freedmen's Bureau. 1972, 100th anniversary of the birth of Paul Laurence Dunbar. 1976, 100th anniversary of the Bargain of 1876. While Du Bois acknowledged that there were many other forthcoming centenaries worthy of celebration, he settled on these six. His selections were far from random. Indeed, they seemed clearly calculated to tell a specific and sharply focused story, only a piece of which I can capture this morning. The story that Du Bois's list of events helps to tell is framed significantly at one end by the Dred Scott decision, and at the other, by the Bargain of 1856. You will surely recall Justice Taney's infamous proclamation in Dred that the African race formed no part of the people who framed and adapted the Declaration of Independence, and therefore blacks had no rights, which the white man was bound to respect. Approximately 20 years later, in 1876, came the notorious bargain of 1876. The deal that Rutherford B. Hayes struck with the Democrats, which resulted in the removal of Union troops from the South, the elimination of voting rights for blacks, and the restoration of white supremacy in the South. This devil's bargain, which spelled the death of Reconstruction, ended to all intents and purposes the federal government's commitment to enforcing the constitutional rights of black citizens. These framing events, or bookends, of Du Bois's story provide but the beginnings of an answer to the journalist's questions. For broadly speaking, we come together to celebrate an organization founded since its beginnings to guarantee the constitutional rights of black Americans, the franchise, not least among them. In other words, the NAACP has devoted itself to doing battle with this country, as this country has waged its own fierce, deliberate, and unwavering battle to deny to black Americans the rights, privileges, and protections of American citizenship. In 1956, when Du Bois issued his call for centenary celebrations, the organization was almost 50 years old. Up to that point, it had been leading the charge in the battle that blacks and their allies were waging, as Du Bois would put it, to claim for themselves every single right that belongs to a free-born American, political, civil, and social. And putting the nation on notice, Du Bois went on to say, until we get these rights, we will never cease to protest and assail the ears of America. The battle we wage is not for ourselves alone, but for all true Americans. As a founding member of the NAACP, Du Bois did indeed make it his lifelong mission to assail the ears of America. Even when he was no longer affiliated with the organization, he helped to shepherd from its fledgling beginnings in a New York apartment to the national force for civil rights and social justice it would become. If the NAACP began as a frail organization, it gathered strength and momentum, becoming, in Laura Wilkins' view, the heart of the civil rights movement and its only muscle. But Wilkins surely knew that the lifeblood of that muscle flowed from the arteries of the local branches, state associations, youth councils, college organizations, and the grassroots dues-paying members that kept the organization pumping, sustaining it even in those periods when it was on life support. I will now retire the cardiac metaphor. Working with these state branches made up of school teachers and postal workers, dirt farmers and housemaids, mechanics and storekeepers, lawyers, ministers, doctors, the NAACP protested against rampant rates of lynching, litigated against disenfranchisement, debt peonage, defended blacks accused of crimes ranging from petty larceny to rape and murder, lent its voice to the International Congress of Races, all within the first few years of its existence. The story of the organization's broad-based efforts ever since would require volumes to tell, but we are fortunate to have in our midst a former fellow of the Carter G. Woodson Institute, Patricia Sullivan, who has told a significant chunk of that story in a recently published volume, which will be the focus of a roundtable tomorrow afternoon. Now 500,000 members strong, the NAACP can proudly boast of being the nation's oldest, largest, and most widely recognized mass-based civil rights organization. Over the next 2 days, we will celebrate the history and legacy of the organization and consider the contemporary implications of its achievements for broader questions of social justice and equality in American national life. In organizing this symposium, the Carter G. Woodson Institute has been animated by the objectives Du Bois had in mind in calling for these centenary celebrations. These should be occasions, he said, for persons of authority to engage in calm and objective inquiry, representing every point of view. Du Bois was ambitious. While we cannot ensure that every point of view will be represented, that would require perhaps a month-long symposium at least. We have brought together an impressive group of scholars and officials who have set themselves the challenge of providing balanced and impartial assessments of the NAACP and are perhaps the most significant stages in its evolution. They come to celebrate but not to idealize, to engage in review but not in reverence, to offer critique but not condemnation, although assessments of this organization have veered historically between these and many other poles. Some are on the opinion, for example, that while it began as a radical organization committed to securing liberty and justice for all, it evolved into the National Association for the Advancement of Certain People. Throughout its existence, the organization has battled the perception that it was a conservative organization of lawyers and banquets limited by the small numbers and cautious temperaments of the Negro middle class, ultimately neglecting the problems facing the black working class. This popular, if uncritical, perception will be contested and nuanced here, as will the equally popular perception that the NAACP was primarily a top-down operation, disdainful of members from its local branches. And yet the documented tensions that sometimes surge between the local branches and the national office cannot be merely swept aside. I think here of Fannie Lou Hamer, one of the poor but powerful activists of Mississippi, who was convinced that the organization was hierarchical. She made it known that she had serious problems with some of the national officials who, to her mind, assumed that local people in Mississippi needed someone to think for them. And of course, anyone who has ever heard of or read about Fannie Lou Hamer knows that no one, absolutely no one, spoke for her. Hamer's perceptions notwithstanding, the local branches of the NAACP, many of them headed by women, Ella Baker, Daisy Lampkin, among others, were the driving force behind countless initiatives of this organization. Harvard-educated lawyers may have litigated cases in the courts, but they worked alongside the humblest members of the black working class, who risked their very lives, as well as their livelihoods, in affiliating with the NAACP. For some, merely joining the organization was tantamount to breaking the law, particularly in those states, including my home state of Alabama, where the organization was prohibited from establishing chapters or functioning. In celebrating the victories of the NAACP, and in charting the distance we have traveled as a nation since 1909, it bears remembering that these victories brought casualties in their wake, not least for African-American teachers in the South, on whose behalf the NAACP brought salary equalization suits as early as the 1930s. As Scott Baker has argued, while historians have amply analyzed the legal dimensions of the salary cases, they have only just begun to acknowledge that this litigation may have eliminated racial restrictions on compensation, but it did not achieve equality. The most important legacy of the salary campaign, he argues, was not equality, but an even higher stage of white supremacy in education. Maneuvering around the law, Southern school boards created the National Teacher Examination, an ostensibly objective test used to measure teacher competence so as to maintain salary differentials based on race. This practice, which decimated the ranks of African-American teachers and principals, represented what James Anderson has termed the marriage of racism and meritocracy. The bitter results of the equalization campaign would not be the only instance in which the NAACP, as well as its detractors, would be compelled to question the limits of litigation in the face of intractable patterns of racial disadvantage. Even after the Supreme Court had ruled that attempts to impose segregation by street or district were unconstitutional, the restrictive deed covenant emerged to avert the letter of the law. While the NAACP designated one of its chief aims the ending of legally restrictive covenants, large numbers of such covenants ran legally into perpetuity. By the end of the 1950s, 40 million dwellings in America, covering approximately 90% of all housing built in this country since 1945, were, because of the force of these restrictive covenants, off limits to non-white purchasers. No symposium on the history and legacy of the NAACP would be complete without some consideration of Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education. Perhaps no piece in the NAACP's litigation armature has been more second-guessed and more subjective to revisionist analysis than Brown, which one of our panelists will also address. Championed immediately in its aftermath as a victory for civil rights and social justice, Brown is now undergoing stringent reassessments, including one provided by yet another panelist. The story that can now be told about Brown, as well as of the many other legislative victories of the NAACP, is one that could only be told in hindsight. The distance of 55 years provides the clarity of insight, not possible at the time that the NAACP's initiatives in the march toward Brown came blushing into view. Whatever conclusions we reach in the next 2 days and beyond will inevitably meet with their own reassessments, but none can alter the fact that Brown was not merely a school desegregation case, as many have argued, diverting attention away from the more pressing issues of labor and economic equality. Rather, it was a case, as Mary Frances Berry has argued, emblematic of our national will to renounce segregation and to live up to the promises of American democracy. While the NAACP began in response to the St. Louis riots of 1906, and focused its energies early on ending the scourge of lynching, renouncing segregation and its vast and debilitating effects became the defining mission of the NAACP. And so it remains today, even as the organization struggles to meet the challenges of an America vastly different from the America it faced in 1909, or for that matter, in 1954. This shifting American landscape, as another panelist will suggest, is inextricably tied to complex global developments and realities that will surely continue to affect and transform the political strategies of the NAACP. But just as the organization had to invent itself in 1909 and reinvent itself numerous times thereafter at crucial historical junctures, it has begun to reinvent itself here on the threshold of its new century, contravening the voices of skeptics who would insist that the organization has lost its relevance. The NAACP continues to show itself to be an organization as vitally necessary today as it was when it birthed itself into being on the centennial of Abraham Lincoln's birth. That day, according to the founders, was not one merely of rejoicing, but more important, of taking stock. Thank you for joining us to take stock here